ओम भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Reading from Canto 9, Chapter 9, Text 33 of the Srimad Bhagavatam. I'm going to go directly into the, we're running a little late, directly into the verse. is it up there? Yeah? Okay. Evam karuna basinya vilapantya natavyat vyagra pashum Ivakadat Sudasa Shapamohita Evam Karuna Basinya Vilapantya Anatavat Vyagra Pashum Ivakarat. That's Ivakadat. Mistake. Sodasa Shapa Mohita. Evam Karuna Basinya. Vilapantya Anatavat. Vyagra Pashum Ivakadat. Sodasa Shapa Mohita. Let's just hold it for one moment. With all due respect, I beg you to not allow your daughter to run around the temple. It's not the proper decorum during a class, nor can she speak or talk or yell or anything else. If that happens, please, I beg you, please take from the temple. If she can stay quiet, please leave her here. We'd love her to hear whatever comes out. Thank you so much. Yes, continue, please. Ladies, please.
Yeah.
synonyms. Evam, in this way. Karuna, excuse me. Karuna Bashanya. While the Brahmin's wife was speaking very pitiably. Vilapantya. Lamenting severely. Anathavat. Exactly like a woman who has no protector. Vyagraha, a tiger. Pashum, prey, animal. Eva, like. Ahadat, ate up. Sodasa, King Sodasa. Shapa, by the curse. Mohitaha, because of being condemned. Translation purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada Ki. Being condemned by the curse of Vasishta, King Sodasa devoured the Brahmin exactly as a tiger eats its prey. Even though the Brahmin's wife spoke so pitiably, Sodasa was unmoved by her lamentation. Purport. This is an example of destiny. King Sodasa was condemned by the curse of Vasishta, and therefore, even though he was well qualified, he could not restrain himself from becoming a tiger-like Rakshasa, for this was his destiny. Talabhyate dukavad anyata sukam, from the Srimad Bhagavatam 1.5.18. As one is put into distress by destiny, destiny can also put one in a happy situation. Destiny is extremely strong, but one can change destiny if one comes to the platform of Krishna consciousness. Karmani nirdatiti kintu cha bhakti bhajam, from the Brahma Samhita 5.54. Om Agina Timiranda Syagananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmalitam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha. Excuse me. So I would like to recap a little bit of this story, especially for those of you who may not have been coming in the last few days. It's very fascinating. Very interesting. It's about King Sodasa. King Sodasa was wandering through the forest, and he saw two Rakshasas there, brothers. And Rakshasas, as you know, they take pleasure in not only killing Brahmins, but eating their flesh. They have a taste for those things. That's why we call them Rakshasas. They enjoy that kind of food. And if they can get that kind of food, they will not stop at anything to try and enjoy it. There were so many evidences in our Vedic culture which indicates that. So he killed, King Sodasa killed one of the two brothers. Killed him because he was Rakshasa. But he spared the life of the other brother in the hope that the other brother would learn from this, that if he went on trying to kill Brahmins and eat their flesh, the same destiny would come to him. So the brother was released, or he was let free, but that didn't mean that he was free from the desire to avenge the death of his brother. So what he did is he hired himself out as a cook for King Sodasa. And one day King Sodasa invited the great sage Vasishta for a dinner. And the brother Rakshasa, who was still alive, being one of the cooks, decided that he would dress the food with human flesh. And cause the muni to become contaminated as a result of eating this flesh. But Vasishtha was quite wise and quite knowing and quite advanced. So when the food arrived at the table and he looked at it, immediately it registered on him that this is impure food. When a person is advanced, he can get that impression. It comes intuitively to him. So what he immediately did is not really think. He immediately assumed, which he should not have done. He assumed that this was the work of King Saudasa, which would have been out of character. Nonetheless, he assumed it was coming from the kitchen of King Saudasa, and King Saudasa must have given the word, give him flesh. So what happened was that he cursed King Saudasa to become a Rakshasa for 12 years. Can you imagine getting cursed unjustly, unfairly for 12 years? The king didn't even have anything to do with that. So what happened was that then a little bit of time passed, and Vasishtha Muni began to meditate on the situation, and he realized, I have cursed an innocent man. And it's not enough to merely say, I'm sorry, will you please forgive me? In those days, if you cursed someone and they had the curse, means that that man was going to live for 12 years like a Rakshasa. Now, King Saudasa was an illustrious person. Let me give a little bit of the history. Sorry. He comes in the line of Ikshvaku. Now, we all know from the Bhagavad Gita that it's mentioned in that very wonderful verse, I believe, in the fourth chapter. This science of and the, can somebody give me the English of the first few words of the that very inch? No, I'm in the second one, but I'm in the first verse, which is I instructed this imperishable science of yoga to Vivasvan, the sun god, and the sun god instructed it to Manu, the father of mankind, and Manu instructed it to Ikshvaku. So Ikshvaku, he knew the Bhagavad Gita, and he passed it on. So it's considered a line of disciplic succession which is illustrious, which is renowned, and which is well known, and which was known, as we will see, by the wife of the Brahmin who is about to lose his life. So King Saudasa was wandering through the forest, and he saw this two Brahmins, husband and wife, and they were in the midst of having sexual intercourse to have a child. So Saudasa, having this mentality of a Rakshasa and being very hungry, the first thing he wanted to do is he wanted to eat the Brahmin, because that's what they do. So he pulled him off, his wife, and he began to growl at him and roar at him. And the wife, as we know from previous verses, pleaded with him, please do not kill my husband. If you kill my husband, you will be in effect killing me, because I cannot live without my husband. He is my all in all. I live to serve him. I live to love him. I live to assist him in every way possible. Please spare him. She spoke in a very, as the verse says, pitiable way. She says, you are from an illustrious family. You come from from these great sages. You know, King Manu and the sun god and Ikshvaku. So you have a noble nature. You know what virtue is. You know what should be done, what should not be done. Please spare him. He was so overwhelmed, so overcome, as Prabhupada says, with this destiny, the desire to enjoy, the desire to satisfy his hunger. And the way a Rakshasa satisfies his hunger is he eats flesh. And so that's what he did. He began eating on the flesh of her husband, killed him. And she was just amazed that this man, who is so knowledgeable in the Vedic science, could not for the moment think like a higher cultured human being, but would think just like an animal. And she became very angry. She says, for this sin that you have committed, killing a Brahmin, the next time that you attempt to have sexual relations with your wife, you will die. So, there it was. That was the end of his relationships. And he wanted to have a son. He wanted to have... So in the future, what happened was that the king knew that he could not engage. So he therefore asked Vasishta, his guru, who had originally cursed him after 12 years, to please lie in for him, so to speak. In other words, that was allowed in the Vedic times. If a man could not produce a child and a wife for one reason or another, then his brother could, or he could ask a Brahmin to do this, and so forth. So anyway, that's what happened. So it shows that what happens in this particular situation. Yes, so I would like to talk a little about two things. I didn't finish the actual story. The story actually ends with the wife being unable to go on without her husband. She takes whatever is left of the body and she lights a funeral pyre and she lies down beside him and the fire comes up and she is killed. Her husband is already dead. And that was, you know, the end of that. So the question comes sometimes, I'd like to kind of add a little something to Saturday's lecture. How does a woman do that? How can she lie down and just let the flames just eat into her body? What enables such a woman to do this? Most person would just start screaming and yelling and shouting, "Ah!" We've seen pictures of people who, for one reason or another, their clothes caught on fire and the clothes which were on fire ate into this flesh and you would see them screaming, "Ah!" And they pour water, get fire extinguishers, put blankets over them and the person was in terrible pain, terrible shock. So how could this woman lie beside her husband as if nothing was going on? It's a very important question because it shows something about the culture of ancient India in the Vanashram system, how a woman loved her husband. Love today is when people get married, often they have an attraction for one another, they have certain things in common, and as a result of those common things which they do together, they supposedly love one another, they have intimacy with one another. They say to each other, "You are my only. I could never love anyone else but you. There is no one like you." Sometimes those things are true, and sometimes they are called sweet little nothings. Wherever the shoe fits, put it on. So anyway, this is what goes on. Very often in what we call worldly marriages. A woman may be married to a man is married to a wife, and man dies, and 2 years pass, 3 years pass, she marries someone else. In spite of the fact of having said, "There is no one like you, I would never marry, no one can compare to you." Because the love is not deep, it's not of the heart, it doesn't go really to the soul. It goes no further than the mind. And consequently, it simply has a sense of warm or intimate sentimentality. But it is not the depth of the soul type of love. That type of love is cultivated. It's developed. And it, as the result of two persons who live together, who love one another in the sense that they enjoy making sacrifices for one another, as a way of serving the Supreme Lord, as a way of saying, "Oh Lord, we love you, and whatever we do for one another is our loving service to you." And so, therefore, they are improving, they are benefiting themselves by making every act an act of loving service to the Lord. Work done as a sacrifice for Vishnu has to be performed. Otherwise, work causes bondage in this material world. Therefore, perform your prescribed duty for his satisfaction, and in that way you'll be freed from the bondage to work. So, one will be freed from the bondage of all attachments when everything is offered to, everything is dedicated to, everything is devoted to the Supreme Lord. Then we become more and more Krishna conscious. Now, in ancient Vedas, the woman considered her husband to be the representative of God. And so she served him as if he were God, with the same respect, the same veneration, the same love, the same affection. And doing difficult things, problematical things, pressure things, stressful things, was never a burden. It was a welcome addition to one's life. Nowadays, if you have a little burden, a little difficulty, why are you always causing me all these problems? You could buy me this convenience, you can buy me this little gadget, and it would save me all the problems of, for example, I don't want to squeeze orange juice anymore. So you buy me an orange juice squeezer. Well, I remember my mother, she used to squeeze. They didn't have squeezer automatics in those days. So I would watch her hand going this way and that way on that little glass thing. Squeeze. And she would always, she loved to squeeze the juice. When I would go to my aunt's house, she was too lazy. She would just cut the oranges and expect me to eat them out of the skin. So I would ask her, I said, "Aunt Sylvia, how come you don't squeeze the orange?" She said, "I don't have enough time." So anyway, I saw that my mother was actually being quite sacrificial. She didn't have to do that. So anyway, the important point is that, well, you know, then the next thing is a blender, and then the next thing is a juicer, and then the next thing I want this, I want that. So it's, and you never buy me enough. You know, what, the neighbor, she just got a new bangle, and you haven't bought me a bangle in 6 months. What do you think I am, your slave? So this mentality is often prevalent. It's not what we call the devotional mentality. Actually, a woman who truly loves her husband and appreciates the hard labor that he puts out. He goes out, you know, breaks his back to earn a living. Sometimes it's out in the hot sun. Sometimes it's in the cold. He doesn't complain. He's glad to offer whatever he has to his family. And he's very grateful that the Lord has given him this service, so that he can take care of his family. And his wife, she's also very grateful that her husband is out. He's taking care of all the necessities so that she can manage the, her business is generally to manage the household, keep it clean, keep it neat, keep it orderly, take care of the children, go out and buy the food, make sure there's enough water in the house, enough for the bath. All of these things are, so the husband who's sensitive and who is spiritual, he doesn't just take them for granted as husbands often do today. Well, I got it coming to me. After all, I go out and I earn the money, and therefore you have to do this. It's your duty. You're mine. Sometimes women, they say, "I'm not your servant. I can go out and get my own job." And they do. So, therefore, the situation is that there was a lack of appreciation. There's this idea of taking one's wife, one's husband, one's children, one's everything for granted. Taking for granted means that I have it coming to me, I deserve it, I should have it, I'm great, I'm wonderful, I'm glorious. This is the kind of pride that destroys marriages. It's false pride. When there's appreciation, then one accepts something with the feeling, and when appreciation for something that is being done for one lovingly and kindly and sweetly and thoughtfully and carefully, then it's not just taken and you gulp it down and that's the end, and she could be just any maidservant. This is a part of my own life. And therefore, thoughtfulness and carefulness and affection is such an important part. And when it's missing in the marriage life, that's what causes these divorces, causes separations, causes fall downs, and all of these things. So the important point is that when a woman loves a husband to the degree that this Brahmin woman did, and also we have in the story of the Mahabharata, where we have Kunti and Madri, similar situation. Pandu was cursed that if he had sexual intercourse, because he killed two deer when they were having sexual intercourse. And although Kshatriyas are allowed to kill deer, they cannot kill them during the act of sexual intercourse. It is illegal. And somehow Pandu forgot that. These two deer were not deer. They were yogis who put on the forms of deer because they couldn't rouse enough passion in their yogi forms. So therefore they entered into a deer type of form. So the male deer, the female, he shot a few arrows actually, and killed both of them. But before the male died, he said, "You will die the same way that I am dying. If you have any sexual intercourse with your wives, you're dead." So when he went back to the, Pandu went back to the ashram and he told his two wives that it's time for them to part, to separate, because he's been cursed. So they should go back to the palace, because he was living in the outskirts in a nice country area. You go back to the palace and you can live a comfortable life. The women said, "What? Live a comfortable life? We should be in comfort. We should be enjoying ourselves. We should be having all sorts of pleasures while you live." He wanted to go into the forest. "You live in the forest. You sleep on the ground. You sit on rocks and you want us to enjoy? Forget it. Do you know who we are?" And he saw that these women were not, they didn't want to give in to this. So he said, "All right, if we live together, if you want to stay with me, then you have to stay like my sisters." They said, "Fine, as long as we're here to serve you. We want to die serving you." You can just see the mentality. Here they were offered the plush, lavish, opulent palace, and they refused it all because they would not bear the idea that their husband should suffer while they are enjoying. That's how much they loved their husband. Rather, they wanted to, like when Sita would walk along the ground, she would clear the pathway for Lord Ram to walk so that he wouldn't walk on any stones or any sticks there. Service mentality. Enjoying it, loving it, welcoming it. Not disgusted by it. So when a woman cultivates this type of mentality, of a pure love for her husband, whom she recognizes as the representative of God. Now, it's not easy for every woman to do this, because sometimes your husband is not as pure as King Pandu was. He was extremely pure devotee. They were living in the Himalayas amongst the sages. Even the sages looked up to him, recognized him as being very great in his meditation, in his purity, in spite of the fact that he was living with his two wives. So in this particular case, when a woman... Well, I want to finish that part of the story about Kunti and Madri, because it actually has a bit of humor in it to a worldly woman. When finally Pandu died because he couldn't control himself one day, he went running after Madri, and she kept screaming, "No, no, no, you'll die, you've been cursed, stop!" But he was overwhelmed with passion, and he couldn't stop, and just as he started... He threw it down, it started, he died. So the question now would be, which of the two women, at that time they already had, there were five children, two from Madri and three from Kunti. You all know which ones. So who is going to do the sati? So Madri said, since I was engaged in the sexual activity with our husband, I would like to take the sati. I would like to lie beside him when the funeral pyre is lit so that when we go back to the heavenly planet, we can finish what we started. So Kunti smiled and she says, "Well, you're not necessary for that. I can do the same thing." So Madri realized that was true. She said, "But there's another factor. And said, what is that? And Kunti was the older, by the way. So the other factor was that she said, my two children recognize you, Kunti, as their mother. They call you mother. And they act toward you the same way they act toward me. But your three children do not act toward me the way my children act toward you, which means you have mothering skills that I don't have. You have a level of affection that I have not been able to cultivate. And therefore, if I raise the children and you take the sati, you are burned. And I'm left. The children will not be getting the best possible mother. In other words, your children don't feel close to me as they feel close to you. And they would feel somewhat uncomfortable and possibly estranged, possibly maybe somewhat alienated, not getting the same degree, the same intensity, the same amount of love that they were getting from Kunti. So Kunti could not defeat that argument. It was a true argument. And she decided, okay, we'll do it. We'll go that way. So I'm just giving an example of how these things tend to work out. So Madri lay down beside Pandu, and the fire went up, and not a whimper out of her. Not, it's hot, hot. Not any of that. Just, where was she? How can you do that? I raised that question at the early part of this talk. How can you do that? Because she was in a condition which only a woman in the deepest of pure love can have for her husband. She was in effect, samadhi. You cannot be impervious to pain unless you are in samadhi. What is samadhi? The withdrawal of the energy from the body, the senses, the mind, and the intelligence. Totally withdrawn, so that if somebody says something, you don't hear it. If somebody pinches your skin, you don't feel it. If somebody puts a rose under your nose, you don't smell it. In other words, the senses are withdrawn, and one is within the heart area. This is the same thing that a yogi does. We have that very interesting example of King Samipya, in which King Pariksit entered his kutir, and Samipya Muni, is it Samikya? Is that A, K or P? You know that, Ashita? Samika? Now, I just want to get it right, so because people are listening. Anybody? Anyway, I think it's Sabika Muni. Anyway, he was in a state of samadhi. So when King Pariksit entered, he had just come from hunting, and he was dry in the mouth, hungry. And so he said, "Oh sage, please, I'm hungry. I'm thirsty. Please get me, have some water." The sage was just sitting like this. "Excuse me, I said I'm thirsty." This is sin like. "I'm thirsty, I'm your king, I protect you. Can you at least give me that courtesy?" No movement, no anything. King got angry. He stomped out of the kutir. He was going down the steps and he saw this snake, dead snake. Took the dead snake, went back up into the kutir, stomped over to the Muni, took the snake and wrapped it around his neck. And there were some little boys outside, and they saw what had happened. And they would tell Samipya Muni's son, Sringi, that what had happened, and that would result in a curse, of course. The point is, the Muni was in samadhi. He didn't hear the king. He didn't smell the king. There was no contact. And we see this throughout the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Pundarika Vidyanidhi, when somebody said something about Krishna, he just immediately went into a trance, fell down on the ground, started rolling around. All he could see is Krishna. When Murari Gupta was up with the king, up on a balcony, and one of the servants of the king, he took this peacock feather fan and he began waving it. And Murari Gupta, being a devotee, saw that fan, immediately it reminded her of Krishna. He became overwhelmed with such ecstasy, he fell off the balcony. The king looked down. He said, my God, what has happened to him? So he went down there. He said, well, are you all right? Is everything okay? Are you hurt? He said, no. He didn't even feel anything. He couldn't, because he was in samadhi. He was with Krishna for that brief time. So he said, what's wrong? He said, I gotta... Now, great devotees don't like to talk about their great levels of consciousness. He said, I have epilepsy. Humility. He doesn't want to be admired for his spirituality. Didn't care about that. So he uses this. And sometimes other devotees, they would give similar types of remarks. Because they don't want to be admired, they don't want to be glorified, they don't want to be applauded, they don't want people bowing down to them as a result of their advanced condition. So, therefore, when the woman is able to absorb herself so deeply in the imagery of her husband, she withdraws herself completely. All the five senses are withdrawn from the external world. So there is no external world. So when the fire touches the skin, she feels nothing. Otherwise, she'd be screaming. This is called a very high level of love. When a devotee loves Krishna so deeply, so intensely, as I have mentioned in those few examples I've given, they don't hear or see anything exterior. We have all to come to that, or strive for that, or aspire for that wonderful, high, elevated condition. This is where we need to be going. It is not enough to simply do our service and leave it at that. We have to be desiring to love Krishna. How do you gain love for Krishna? You gain love for someone when you develop appreciation for them. So why should... sorry. We appreciate someone when we think about the things they're doing for us, which they don't have to do. For example, Krishna feeds us, provides us with food, gives us the clothing, gives us shelter, gives us education. This is all spiritual education. And when we're sick, gives us medication. He's taking care of us. There are many people right now, they're not eating. They haven't eaten since yesterday. They're not going to eat today. There's some people who walk around with threadbare pieces of cloth. There are some people who have sick, terrible diseases and disorders, and they have no money to get medical attention. So when Krishna is giving us these things, we should not take them for granted. They must be taken with the full understanding that if he so wishes, and we have all committed sins of one degree or one kind or another at some point in our lives. And if Krishna wanted to hold that against us, then he could say, well, you know, you did this, you did that, you did this. I'm not going to feed you today. I'm not going to let you have your paycheck. You're going to have to fight for your paycheck this week. Or you're going to sign in for unemployment insurance. I'm going to make it difficult for you. You're going to have to wait a month to get that insurance when normally it should have taken you 1 week. Krishna can make it difficult. He could make it problematic. He could make it troublesome. But he makes it easy for the devotee so that the devotee will have the time, the energy, the vitality, the vigor to pursue his spiritual goals. It's so important. When we get hamstrung with all these different obstacles, different pressures, different stresses, when we get hamstrung, you can't think of Krishna even. Very difficult unless you're already very advanced. Almost impossible. That's why Krishna says to Arjuna, therefore, Arjuna, you should always think of me in the form of Krishna. And at the same time, perform your prescribed duty of fighting. With your activities dedicated to me, and your mind and intelligence fixed on me, you will come to me without a doubt. So Krishna is saying, keep your mind on me. The more you keep your mind on me, the more you appreciate me, the more you think of me, The more you love me, show affection for me, the more you do sacrifices for me, the more you will become attached to me. And the more attached to me you become, the more you will be able to enter that deep state that I was talking about before, where you lose yourself in the pastimes of Krishna. That's why we must read this Krishna book as often as possible, so that we can develop an affection, an attachment. I read this Krishna book upstairs in the prasadam room when it was up there, believe it or not, for 21 years in a row, almost every day. Why did I do that? I came to this movement to try and get attached to Krishna. And I knew the easiest way to do that is to keep talking about him and sharing him and giving him to others. And if you do that, Krishna is pleased. And he will then enable us to come closer and closer as he more and more gives more and more of his grace, his kindness, his sweetness, his affection, his mercy. Sometimes devotees say, I don't feel I'm getting the mercy. Well, what are you doing to get it? Well, you know, I'm doing my service. Are you doing it with love? Well, sometimes. How much times? How many times? Well, whenever I get a time, whenever I think of it. No, that's not the way it should be done. You have to figure out some way to remember Krishna throughout your day. Whether you're crossing the street, whether you're walking up the stairs, whether you're eating your prasadam food, whatever. We need to remember Krishna, not just remember him. Oh yes, he's God, he's great, he's omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent. That's not enough. Remember him lovingly. Thank you, my Lord. You're allowing me to eat. You're giving me food. You're giving me this clothing. You're giving me this wonderful spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada. You're giving me his books. You're giving me a line directly to your heart. I am so much indebted to you as a result. Please let me never forget that. And if I don't forget it, then my path will be not only sublime, but completely fulfilled. And I know I will be with you, not only here today, but forever. So we need to desire that. Nothing comes without desire. And if we desire this, Krishna will afford us, will facilitate us, will enable us to love him more and not take everything and anything for granted. I know I do that. I take for granted. I got this thing I told you about, it, the tattoo, the K on my wrist. Because I look at my watch, I can't help but seeing K. Ah, Krishna. So maybe three times in a whole day I'll remember Krishna. Because I look at my watch three times. That's better than nothing. So the important point is, of course, I'm being a little facetious. Actually, I look at it more than three times. The whole point is to remember Krishna as often as possible. Always remember me, Krishna says. And in this way you will come to me. So our whole business, our business is to remember Krishna, to appreciate what he's giving us. And the more we appreciate, the more Krishna will bless us. The more he blesses us, the more he gives us his grace, the more love we will feel for him. The more love we feel for him, the more we want to do for him. The more you want to do for him, the more you want to sacrifice for him. The more you want to sacrifice for him, the more you will think it is not even a sacrifice because I owe him so much, much more. And when we act in this mentality, you see, that I owe him so much more, then we don't look to be honored, glorified, appreciated, applauded for our little service. Rather, we always feel we haven't done enough or we haven't done it well enough. And if we have that mentality, we will keep growing and growing and growing, and Krishna will be get pleased and more pleased and more pleased, and the blessings will flow, and everyone here will be sharing with one another those blessings which will result in an ever-increasing spiral of ecstasy. All glories to Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Hare Krishna. Are there any questions? Yes, I see a hand going up. No? Or you're stretching. Yeah, go ahead. Get the microphone to someone. Just hold it 1 second. Because the persons on the net want to hear it. Yeah, good and loud, because...
Thank you for such a nice class, Prabhu. I was just wondering, you mentioned about Krishna making it easy to
making
get
what?
Things... You mentioned that Krishna was making it easy for devotees to get things done. you know, so that
making it easy.
Yeah. And so I was wondering about somebody who may be like practicing Krishna consciousness.
Who may what?
Somebody who might be practicing Krishna consciousness, but things aren't going as smoothly. Could you maybe explain that?
Yes. Well, when they don't go as smoothly, then very often a devotee is... Did everyone get the question? If things are not going so smoothly, and they're not always going to go smoothly, sometimes Krishna puts obstacles there so that you develop the quality of tolerance, the quality of endurance, the quality of patience. How will you develop those qualities unless things are a little rough and tough? So if you're flying off the handle when things are not going smoothly, it means that you have to be praying a little harder. You need to psyching up your mind. I need to be more stable, more controlled, more focused, more centered. And then when things are not going so easily, I'll just be patient and deal with it. And that's all that should be. You deal with it, get it over with, and go on to the next thing. Even if it takes 5 times longer than it normally would. The main point is that, I mean, sometimes my computer goes down. I have to sit there 5 hours with a technician. I could be doing something better. But I think, this is my test. So I guess I just have to sit here until he fixes it. And yeah, while I'm doing that, and sometimes you're waiting, and then he'll interrupt, you know, little chat sessions going back and forth. Well, I want you to do that. Anyway, 4 or 5 hours can go by. So you just accept it. This is Krishna's way of improving my tolerance, improving my patience, my endurance, my steadiness. Okay? You understand that? So don't curse Krishna the next time he puts an obstacle in your way. Thank him for it. Any other question? Yeah. Okay, I see another hand go up. Yes, sir, Prabhu, right here. You? Yeah, go ahead.
I had a question about King Sudasa. After he was cursed to become a Rakshasa, and then Vashishtha realized that he had made a mistake by cursing him, he went back to the queen, and he had desire for sexual relations.
I'm not hearing you. You've got to project your voice, please. Thank you. You can come up a little closer.
When the King Sudasa was uncursed by Vashishtha...
No, right there. Go.
Okay. When King Sudasa was uncursed by Vashishtha,
yeah,
and he went back to his queen and had desires for sexual relations, and then he was cursed because of the wife before that he had taken her husband's life. What happened to was that King Sudasa or another king? After that, after Sudasa was uncursed, uncursed.
Vashishtha, yeah.
By Vashishtha.
Yeah.
And then there was a king who had desire for sexual relationships, and I was wondering that who was the name of that king? Was it Sudasa after he was uncursed, or was it another king?
No. What happened initially is that Sudasa, he was the one who Vasishtha cursed. Okay, so he was cursed for 12 years. But then Vasishtha discovered that he had made a mistake. And therefore he himself undertook penance or austerities for 12 years in order to pay for this, if you will, crime. Okay, so during that 12-year period, Sudasa was completely overcome by the mode of ignorance and passion and was acting like a Rakshasa. Even though he had come from illustrious family, which I mentioned, you know, from the Bhagavad Gita, the sun god, Vivasvan, and Manu, and Ikshvaku, that whole line. So, but after 12 years, of course, as was mentioned, Sudasa was cursed by the Brahmin, Mataji. She cursed him that if he would have tried to have sexual intercourse with his wife at some point, he would die. So therefore, he could not do that. Therefore, he had his guru, Vasishtha, who agreed to this to fill in for him so that there would be a son. Now, in Vedic culture, the father is considered the one who raises the child and not who is necessarily the biological father, the one who raises it. Like Pandu raised the 5 Pandavas, but he was not the biological father of these persons. Okay? Do you have the understanding? If you have any further question, I can answer further after the class. Any other questions? Yes, good.
Thank you, Prabhu. I was just wondering if you have any other, I guess, techniques for remembering Krishna throughout the day. Or remembering
the doors
Krishna.
Are opening. I'm not hearing you, so please go ahead.
I was just wondering if you have any other tips for remembering Krishna throughout the day.
Well, I already gave you one. I have this watch which says time, and that's Krishna's name. He says, time I am. I got it from Time magazine for a subscription that I had given about 15 years ago. But different ways you can remember, yes. Years ago, on radio, to advertise products, they used to have what they call jingles, you know, like Pepsi Cola hits the spot, 12 full ounces, that's a lot, a nickel buys a bottle too, Pepsi Cola is the drink for you. I learned that when I was 6 years old, and I never forgot it. So it shows you repetition, repetition, repetition. When you chant the Hare Krishna mantra, understand, I'm touching Krishna. I'm touching Krishna. How blessed I am. How grateful I should be. If you think like that, not just, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, got that over with finally. No, I'm touching Krishna. Krishna is allowing me to touch Him. Me, sinner that I have been, sinner that I even am, I forget Him all day long. Please, please help me. Beg Krishna, help me to remember you. I'm such a fool, such an idiot. Here I have the greatest treasure in the world, and I forget you. So these are kind of prayers that I'm just giving you a little intimation, a little hint. If you think those are done, you don't discuss these with other persons. It's between you and Krishna, you and your spiritual master, you and the deities, okay? So just try to remember how important it is. You could die tomorrow. But we don't think like that. I'm 24 years old. How can I die tomorrow? I got a whole life ahead of me. No! I had one assistant. He was working for me. And he drove a motorcycle. And one day he went out, and next day he was dead. He was killed on his motorcycle. He was a devotee mother's child. So you don't know. If you consider every moment precious and a possibility of death coming soon, then you begin to cherish each moment and utilize it to the maximum. Okay? Okay, I think everybody must be hungry now. Hare Krishna, thank you again for your kind audience.
$50 a shot. You better get our own.